Okay, so today I'm going to give a talk on truthfulness. This has been our topic for the month of August, as we go through the 10 paramis. So, as has been mentioned earlier in these talks, there are kind of two sides to this topic of truthfulness. There is maybe the most obvious, which is the behavioral side, right? This is the side where we're being urged to be truthful, to act in a truthful manner. And that's worth its own discussion. But there's also this other side of truthfulness and what we're trying to cultivate, which is the ability to perceive what is true, right? These two sides are really related. And to mention that, I want to point out that for the behavioral side, to tell the truth, we need two things. We need to want to tell the truth, right? We need to have that ethical motivation. But we also need the perceptual side. We need to see clearly what the truth actually is. Otherwise, we're not going to be telling the truth. We're going, despite our best of intentions, we're going to be saying something or behaving in a way that we believe to be true, perhaps, but which is actually clouded by our own perceptions, right? That's just one of the ways they're related. So I want to start with I want to start with a story, a couple of stories. And they're a little on the behavioral side. So one story that came up immediately for me when we started talking about this topic among those of us who are assistant teachers for Sunday sets is that I run into this sometimes because of a different cultural background that some of my relatives have for myself. And it's, this isn't to be generalized. I don't think this is something specifically Indian. It's something in my family. And it's that when someone is sick, and especially as people become terminally ill or have terminal conditions that are either going to result in their death or, the impairment of their minds, things like dementia. There has been a tendency in my family to kind of not talk about it, and especially not with the person experiencing it. And for example, with people who have been terminally ill, like I had an aunt who was diagnosed with cancer, it was considered imperative by her husband that we not tell her that it was terminal. And he felt that in doing so, he was both protecting her from something that would be devastating, protecting her parents who were still alive from something that would devastate them. And also, in a way, he was allowing positive change to occur. By not saying, "Hey, this is terminal, this is going to happen," he was somehow allowing some possibility of some kind of a self-motivated miracle to occur. Hey, if she doesn't know this, if she can believe in her own recovery, maybe it can just happen. So the root in some way of this was trying to protect others and trying to come up with a good result. So this is a form of untruthfulness rooted in some very well-meaning ideas. I found it really challenging because my cultural upbringing is different from theirs, And for me, without analyzing it myself, I just felt like, no, we have to tell the truth. We have to tell the person what's happening. We have to tell the people around them who love them what's happening. And I think I first had to question why is that just something cultural in me, or is there a good reason? And I also had to sort of think in them, well, what's the reasoning for them? How do we come to some conclusion? One thing that I think is behind that desire to protect others, Ajahn Suchito talks about this, is sometimes when we're trying to protect others or we claim that need, we're really trying to protect ourselves, right? We are making an assumption about how the other person will respond. We're making an assumption about how it will hurt. And we're protecting ourselves from experiencing that and from having to be the one who does that. I think on my side of this also, there is some protection that was going on. By relying on some sort of moral imperative or some cultural imperative, no, we just need to tell the truth, I was bypassing the pain and the suffering that does get caused when something like that is released, right? Maybe these are necessary moments of suffering. Maybe they're moments of suffering that growth comes out of. But by just saying, no, it's a thing we have to do, I was allowing myself to not have to think about that. And again, in some way, I was avoiding the suffering of telling myself, you're going to be saying something that hurts people, at least superficially or at least in the moment, you're going to be doing that. By just saying, no, it has to be done. So that's one story. No resolutions here, but it's a subtle way that, you know, we can, it's a tricky example of dealing with truth, right? A much simpler example that I worked with when I first started meditating, well, before I started meditating, let me tell you about that first. I, for all of my life, for reasons I don't quite understand, I get really angry when I hear a loud noise. If I hear something loud near me, I just get angry. And I don't have any way of controlling that first reaction of anger. It just happens. And before I started meditating seriously, I would start acting from that anger. You know, I would find all kinds of things. I would look around me after a loud noise occurred, and I would find all kinds of things that were wrong. You know, something that, you know, maybe someone didn't clean something up in the kitchen, or there were all these, you know, there were these tasks piling up. Someone was thinking, asking something unreasonable of me. The anger just found all of these other things to hook onto and became this, you know, it started telling all these stories about all these reasons I had to be outraged or angered or irritated. And when I was able to recognize, oh, I just get angry when I hear a loud noise. There's nothing more to it. It just immediately started to calm down. It immediately started, once it was seen and recognized for what it was, it didn't have to latch on to other things. I could just see this truth that I just get angry when I hear a loud noise. And it just passes very quickly now. I get angry, it goes away. And I can just move on. I don't have to keep it going. So what are we talking about there? That's another kind of root that is based in truthfulness, that has a story about truthfulness here. When we're clouded by urges, biological conditioning, cravings, all these things, when we're not able to see them clearly, they can color our perception of what the reality is around us, what the truth is around us. I saw all these problems after a loud noise in my environment. It colored my reality. It colored my sense of truth. And it's only when I could just kind of see, oh, this is just a loud noise thing. That's all that's going on here. I could see a little bit more clearly. Okay, I have this feeling of anger. It's not attached to everything in my universe. It's just attached to that loud noise. And I can see more clearly everything else that's going around me and how it's actually just okay. So I want to take a moment to practice briefly with all of you. I'm going to ring a bell, and just as preparation, I'm going to ask you to think about a time when you were untruthful. So this, I don't want you to pick the hardest thing in your life. I want you to pick something that feels like you can work with it in just a couple of minutes and let it go. So I'll ring a bell. We'll begin this brief practice. And I'll ring one bell again in a few minutes when we end. All right? There'll be some guidance. So close your eyes. And bring to your mind a moment when you weren't fully truthful. This could be a moment when you exaggerated. It could be a moment when you just kept quiet about the truth. It could be a moment when you thought you were being truthful, but you couldn't really see the truth. Be a well-intentioned moment. Now, I want you to take a moment to think about what motivated that moment. Was it a craving? Like you really wanted something or wanted to avoid something? A feeling of, I really need this. Could be that we wanted someone to like us. Was there any aspect of you protecting your ego or some idea about who you were? Was there desire to avoid pain or difficulty? Was there some part of you that believed it was truth, or maybe was unwilling to see the whole truth? Or was it just that the truth didn't seem so important at the time? Often it's some combination of things. Okay. Take a moment to get back in your body. Take a deep breath. Recognize that these moments occur for everyone. We share them in common. So, I want to return to something I said earlier, which is to tell the truth. We need two things. We need to want to tell the truth, and we need to see clearly what the truth is. Right? Both are required. So for that behavioral aspect of truthfulness, to even tell the truth, what we're saying is we need as part of it both this desire, and we also need this perceptual aspect of truthfulness. We need to see clearly what the truth is. So, wanting to tell the truth, right? This is part of what was at stake in that example I gave with my relatives, right? You know, I could talk to them about what was going on when my aunt had terminal cancer, but, you know, there was actually a feeling that, no, I don't want to tell the truth here first, right? So what do we bring in this tradition, there is a sense that part of sila, part of morality, is that we have to have a desire to tell and spread the truth. we have to be morally aligned, right? So to want to tell the truth, we need this specific moral alignment. We talked for a whole month about sila, so I won't talk too much here, but I want to mention one of the things that came up there. When we're morally aligned and have a value to tell the truth, there's a lightness that comes from this, and there's a clarity that comes from this. We're not caught up in holding a web of deceptions. And we're not caught up in needing to convince ourselves at some level of those deceptions. Because we have to do that in order to speak them at some level. Right? So we're getting closer to seeing clearly what's there. Another aspect is generosity. Right? We need to have empathy for others, and we need to want the best for them as well as ourselves. Right? We need to hold ourselves and our needs a little more lightly and in the flow of the needs of all beings. Right? We need to have that care for everyone around us. And when we're away from truth, and some of you may have experienced this in the meditation, when we're away from truth, there's often a placing of ourselves first that's taking place. There's often some aspect where there's something about ourselves that we're protecting, or a need of ours that we're serving, or want of ours, rather, that we're serving. So together, when we are getting in touch with sila, morality, and generosity, we can get in touch with our own hearts, and we can clear and steady our intentions. And so this is seen as kind of a prerequisite for telling the truth, right? We're sort of setting a compass, and we're saying, okay, we actually want to tell the truth. We're going in this direction. We have this desire. So the second part, seeing clearly what the truth is, this perceptual aspect of truthfulness. How can we actually see the truth, right? First, I want to talk a little about what's in the way. And so as I was reading and listening to talks this morning, a diagram came to me. So I made a really dinky diagram with just the paint app that you have over here, and I'm just going to share it. I hope no one screen captures this so it never gets seen again and no one can pick it apart. But I just want to share this diagram really quick. Can everyone see that? Is that taking up the screen? Give me a thumbs up if someone can see that. Okay, great. So I didn't draw that eye. I have no such artistic skills. I just drew the stuff on the right. So one way of thinking about what gets in the way of truth is that there are all these things that are filters or layers between us and the truth, right? At some of our deepest levels, there's biological condition, right? I mean, you might think of like sexual urges or hunger or things like that that can cloud our vision of reality, our vision of what's going on. Then there's social conditionings, beliefs, ideas. Maybe we have ideas when we see a person who looks a certain way. Maybe they're just kinds of values, you know. It can be as simple as things made of wood seem better than things made of plastic. And so we look at things with a prejudgment, right? Maybe those are based in truth. Maybe those are conditioning. There are layers of expectations and assumptions, right? We've developed these all our lives. There are mental shortcuts that we've developed. We see one thing over and over happen, and then we shortcut. We don't need to see it again. We just have an expectation about what's going to happen. We make assumptions. Preferences and wishes, these are our cravings, right? This is the layer of all the things we desire, all the things we are averse to, all the ways we wish things were, right? These can all affect our perception. And so those red arrows that are kind of going off to the sides are, the way I kind of see it, the way I think of this as an image is, when we're trying to see the truth, all of these things can kind of refract our lens, right? We can get our vision bent in different directions by all of these things. So how do we get that straight arrow that sees through these things to the truth? So one tool is meditation, right? And what are we trying to do in meditation? We're trying to establish a stable connection to just awareness so we can see clearly all the factors in between us and truth. We can distinguish that which is still from those things which are impermanent, which arise and come about and fall away. All right, enough of my diagram. Stop the share. Here we are back with each other again. Okay, so how do we get there is often informed. So Ajahn Suchito has this beautiful way of describing the path to seeing that, to establishing that straight ahead arrow where we're seeing truth in terms of the other paramis that we've already discussed before truthfulness, right? We already talked about the role of generosity and of morality, right? As kind of establishing a compass, a genuine desire to see the truth. And then when we're looking at how do we actually see clearly, one of the things that really helps here is renunciation, is letting go. And here I specifically mean of letting go of all the attachments, our cravings, our aversions, these things that color the way that we see the world. We can only see clearly when we're not really caught up in attachments. And when we let go of our attachments, what we mean is not that they disappear. What we mean is that we see them clearly and they begin to arise and fall away naturally. So one example here that is backed by a lot of research is emotions. So I was recently in a workshop where the whole group was asked, how long do emotions last? How long does an emotion last? And we got answers in the room from years to months to days to hours to minutes. And from a standpoint of research, when people actually measure and know where an emotion comes up in the body and measure the body's reaction to an emotion to see how long an emotion actually lasts, the answer is somewhere between 5 and 30 seconds for an emotion to come through us and fall away. When we experience an emotion that's lasting much longer than that, what we're doing is we're re-triggering that emotion over and over and over again. We're caught up in the emotion. We feel the emotion. It tells us a story. We re-trigger the emotion again. This is like my anger example, right? I get angry over and over and over again, not just because of the loud noise, but because of all the things I see afterwards and then become colored by the anger and entangled in the anger, right? So if we let go, if we're able to renunciate and let go of our attachments to all these phenomena that arise, things come and pass quickly. And in meditation specifically, we can get a sense of what is relatively still and what is moving through us, what is arising and falling, what is impermanent. And you may have this experience when you meditate, when you get really still, you might hear a noise, it comes and it goes. You might feel an emotion, it comes and it goes. If we can get really still, thoughts just become like blips. A thought arises, a thought disappears. The next thought arises, the next thought disappears. And when we can see those things as moving, as impermanent, if you imagine my diagram again of it, you know, all of those layers on top of the truth are to some extent layers that kind of shift and wobble and twist. It's only the truth in the middle that's relatively still, right? And once we see those things shifting and wobbling around the truth in the middle, we can discern the difference between them and the truth in the middle. So renunciation, letting go. We let go in order to let things arise and pass more quickly and fluidly. Once they arise and pass more quickly and fluidly, we're able to see truth more easily. Wisdom, discernment, right? When we have an intention like telling the truth, we're aided by being able to discern what is in the service of our intention, what is not in the service of our intention. We recognize all the energies that are present in a moment that pull us in various directions. And we think, what here is skillful, what here is unskillful, right? An example that I came up recently with, which I'm not going to go into detail with given the time, is I was asked to evaluate a colleague at work who was a difficult colleague. So immediately in trying to write that kind of reference, you know, like I had to tell their supervisor how they are, all these energies arise, right? And then I have to distinguish, okay, what's skillful here? What's not skillful? What is in the service of truth? What is not in the service of truth? What is just an emotional pull in one direction or another, right? And so I had to use this discernment, right? Hopefully I did it well, but to see like, well, what's worth bringing up here? What's not? What is in the service of truth? Energy, patience, these are things we worked with in the last 2 months. And these support and empower our wisdom. This is allowing us to apply with intention, with enthusiasm, our desire to tell the truth. This is something I've been working on, energy in particular, is something I've been working with a lot recently. I think I didn't pay it close enough attention for a lot of my practice. And I used to, you know, to move so much on the side of letting go, of renunciation, of acceptance, that I didn't realize that, you know, when I've detached a little from the phenomena that are coming around me, you can kind of get into this floaty space. And if you don't remember what your intention is, like if my intention during a meditation is to be clearly present with this moment, to notice what's going on in this moment, I can kind of get into this trance-like state. And I need to apply energy to say, no, I really have an intention here. If your intention is truthfulness, this is about staying on the path. Patience. Very related in a way, right? Patience defined here as the ability to bear with something difficult. The ability to bear with something difficult. Along with energy, it's kind of required to stay the course, right? We have to have patience with ourselves. We have to see these things arising and passing. And when they arise, we have to know with patience they will pass, right? When we're in difficult states, they can tell us that they're permanent. Right? They have this ability to tell us they're going to stay forever. We have to have patience. We have to ride them out. Okay, that's enough for me. Thank you for listening. And I just loved, I couldn't help myself but mention these, because all those things, energy, patience, renunciation, wisdom, generosity, sila, they may sound familiar. They are all the things we've covered in the previous months this year, and they are all in the service of truth. This isn't my observation. This comes from Ajahn Suchipa's book, where he kind of outlines all these beautifully. Okay, so now we'll divide up into groups. I'll divide us into groups of three or four, and we can discuss how. And so we don't have to discuss times when we were untruthful. We can discuss instead in these groups times when we told the truth, even though it was challenging, and what aided us in those moments. That's a prompt if you want. Otherwise, you can discuss anything else that came up for you naturally as we went through the meditation and the talk. Now I'll go to the task of setting us into groups. We'll take about 15 minutes, maybe about 13 minutes, actually, and discuss. And then we'll come back to the main group after. All right. Welcome back, everyone. So we have some time now to talk about, as a full group, Any questions that have come up, any comments that came up for you through the talk or through the sharing? A reminder that anything that was mentioned in the group by anyone aside from you is to be held in confidence. And but you can express your own reflections on something if it doesn't give away what someone shared in that confidence. And to take questions, you can raise your hand. You might see a raise hand button on the bottom. Sometimes it's buried under React. And if that doesn't work for you, you can unmute yourself. Oh, I see Monica's hand is raised. Yeah.
Yeah, hi. I am really grateful for this talk, and we talked in our group, and this is the piece that I find the most important and complex is really the perception of truth.
Yeah.
Because we are all taught things from our society, parents, that like later we have to unlearn to be, you know, better human beings. And meditation has helped me a lot with that. The piece that I still struggle with, and I took actually notes, and I will be applying all these things to, you know, really the truth seeking. But if you have, you know, a conversation with someone and you're trying to arrive at a place of understanding, and let's just say understanding of the truth,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, your perceptions of a certain event are so vastly different as it happens in life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, let's assume that, which may not be true at this point, but let's assume that I have done a lot of work on this diagram you showed, and I have really tried, put in significant effort to eliminate bias and to really kind of arrive at an understanding that is really factual based. And I mean, meditation is one really important way to do this. But you know, if you're, you know, I'm a former scientist, they have a way to separate facts from interpretation. You know, lawyers have a way to separate, you know, like there are other things you can do that are professional and hopefully in the kind of common, perception and common understanding of things. How do we work with someone who really is not willing or able to do the same? To, you know, so when their perception is so out there that you cannot meet.
Yeah.
And that's, I don't know that you necessarily anyone has an answer, but I just wanted to put that out there. And it's a real situation I have at work.
Sure.
And someone said, well, you just don't understand what I'm saying. And I don't really think that. I mean, maybe it's also on me, but like, how do we get there when like the Venn diagram of truth is
right.
overlapping?
Yeah.
And I mean, if you have any thoughts, great, but I know it's on.
Sure. First of all, has anyone else experienced anything like this before? Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of hands go up. This is an experience that is very, very common, right? And so I do have some thoughts, and these are those thoughts. One is, I come from a background of research and, you know, empirical, quantitative, data-driven research. And I can sometimes wield that in a way that doesn't acknowledge its own limitations. For example, we choose which questions as researchers we are answering, right? We choose which evidence is stronger and which is less. I can do this thing where if I think someone is not arguing from an evidence-based standpoint, I can immediately start discounting everything they're saying. You know, like, this is a person not grounded in these things. And again, I'm giving weight to certain kinds of evidence when I do that. So there are all these choices that guide even the rational process. There's also all this research recently that change, well, this is a little to the side, but it changes the role that emotions play in rationale. We used to, a lot of us have grown up with this idea that emotions are these things that get in the way of thinking clearly or being rational or applying rational methods. And the ideas, the evidence-based ideas that have come up more recently is that emotions act as a starting point for guiding our rationale and for pointing us in the directions of inquiry where we actually even choose to apply rational scientific methods. And, you know, if you're a research, you know, one thing you probably find in research all the time, or at least I do, is you often get strangely conflicting evidence where you have to come up with a theory that unites all of the data points. And if we're focused on certain directions versus others, you could imagine only getting part of the truth and not the rest of the truth, right? So I just want to acknowledge that to begin with. So, and along with that, as a meditative point, it helps in these kinds of things to first recognize where we're holding on to our arguments because they come from us. Because we're identified more with this body, this self, this mind's opinions than the opinions of that body, that mind, that self. And if we can detach enough sufficiently to say, this is what this body thinks and feels, these are the reasons, and actually put ourselves more genuinely in the other person's shoes to say, what could be motivating their own logic? Genuinely, so not just picking apart their argument, which is what my tendency is. I put myself in the other person's position, and then I start picking apart all the things I find there. Well, this is wrong for this reason. But genuinely trying to see what their perspective is. This can all be in the aid of truth. Now, having said all of that, sometimes someone is just wrong. Right? And, you know, there is a such thing. As, you know, if we are to say that there is a such thing as truth, then I would just open the invitation that there is a such thing as not truth. And there is a time when it's worth recognizing. We use discernment to recognize when one is true and when is not, and another thing is not. But I just want to throw in the caution beforehand of there are so many pitfalls along the way to making that decision where we can be biased or emphasize the ways in which we're used to thinking, the patterns in which we're used to thinking over the ways that someone else might be thinking and truly understanding their perspective. That's my thoughts on this. I'm sure there's like as many opinions on this as there are people in the room because you picked a really good question. Thank you. Yeah, Nikhil next.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I really appreciated your talk and your story about the disagreement in your family about how to what was the truth to convey. I really appreciated that in particular because I noticed that as you were telling that story, I had this like rush to judgment of like, of course the truth is that you must tell this person this news, right? And kind of realizing that, oh, there's this judgment here, and where is the truth actually? Like, right? Like, I think you point to this later on when you were talking about with the diagram and the various circles of things that obfuscate the truth, like our conditioning or environment, social environment, the context, all these other things that obfuscate our ability to see the truth, and kind of realizing that, you know, so I think sometimes these things that seem the most obvious and we shortcut to the most are the places that we sometimes need to analyze the most, where is actually the truth. And, you know, I think with that example, I started realizing, well, like, what is this truth that's really being shared? You know, like we've all been dying for like our entire existence. So what is the truth that needs to be shared? How, like, where is it? And what should be said? What needs to be said? And so, I just really appreciated that.
Oh, what a great point. That's such a great point, Nicole. Thank you. Yeah. In what I was planning to share there, what is truth, right? What is, you know, I might say like, oh, this person is dying. They need to know they're dying. You point out that even that perception is something that has a little to do with conditioning. We're dying every moment. something in some way has accelerated that process for this person. What does it mean to die if we, you know, if we think that we just return to the earth and we continue to support other life? You know, we can have all kinds of ideas about what happens with death. And how do we place dying in that? Is this really a product of my beliefs, my shortcuts, my mental shortcuts, even the way I would phrase it or think about it? That's an excellent point. Yeah. Yeah. And it shows me how pervasive this kind of question is, this real challenge to ourselves to really interrogate what the truth is. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, Suze.
I just wanted to bring up, I was really touched by the sharing in our small group that sometimes out in the non-Buddhist world, the non-Dharma world, how challenging it can be and all the different issues that come up of not being safe and all of our own issues. And while we meditators, fall flat many times as well, I'd really like people to encourage us to use the Sangha to practice. You know, when truthfulness is hard, you know, reach out and get some Dharma friends, just a buddy that you practice with. And I know that that has made a huge difference for me when I've had entanglements with my Dharma friends. We've got some skills here, just like you were mentioning, all the paramis and pausing and knowing that we can apologize, all that. So I think we've got opportunities here to do that.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Suze. What a great way to use the Sangha. Yeah, in the service of truth. And to create the safety, you mentioned the safety too, or the difficulty we can have in finding that path. Yeah, it's not always safe to have that conversation. You know, where we're really exposing ourselves when we're trying to identify what is really the truth. Sometimes that uncovers some uncomfortable places in ourselves too, right? What a good use of Sangha. What a good way to leverage that community that we have here. Especially when we're aligned, right? Like where we all know together what we're trying to do. We're not trying to just sort of, you know, inflate the other person and say, no, you're right and they're wrong. We're trying to get to truth, right? We have a group of people earnestly interested in that. Yeah. Thank you.